Hello and welcome to an all new episode of the Spotlight Authors Edition. I am one of your hosts, Kente, all the way live from Los Angeles, California, and I'm joined by my wonderful, beautiful, talented co-host,
Renee, all the way from Silver Spring, Maryland.
Silver Spring. Don't say Silver Springs.
Please do not.
Right. All right. So how you been? How was your day?
It was pretty good. Busy. Working on a couple of proposals and, you know, writing, editing, reviewing stuff. Working on some resumes for people. So, but okay. Good. How about yours?
Pretty good, actually. I did pretty good. Now, have you worked on your book since the last show?
Actually, yes. I'm working on illustrating the illustration process for the children's book. So I finished two last night. So hope to work on a few more before the night's over.
All right. You know what you should do is kind of film your process a little bit.
And that might get
a little something extra for when the book comes out, you know?
Good idea. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. So our guest tonight is a old friend of our network. I was on her show the first time. I mean, her first time doing a podcast. Couldn't even tell because she seemed like a veteran. And now this young lady has just been killing the game with books, podcasts, YouTube, reality shows. I mean, movies as well. And this person comes all the way from Canada. It's the one and only L.A. Wade. How you doing, L.A.?
Hey, L.A.
So happy to see your two faces together.
Me too.
Thank you.
Yes.
Now, for those who may not know who you are, just give a little background to who you are.
Man, you think that's an easy question? That's the hardest question you've given me. My name is L.A. Wade. I come from Toronto, Canada, and I'm an author. Hey, Andre, what's going down? I'm an author. I am a newly found director, podcast host, a mental health advocate, and I care desperately about people with melanated skin. That's the best way I know how to say it.
All right. Now, I want to kind of go back to in the way back machine.
Can you make the song go? What I want to do right here is go back and then.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Mr. DJ. Yeah. Now, the first time I met you was on a podcast hosted by Dr. Vibe. Oh, and yeah. I remember when I was told that, I think you told me way later, you was like, you know, that was my first thing I ever was on. I was like, very surprised because you felt at home and whatnot. And to see where you're at now is so incredible. I mean, one thing I love about what you do is you say, like a lot of people say, I'm going to do this. I'm going to scale Mount Kilimanjaro. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to do this.
By the way.
This next. But when you say you're going to do something, you do it. Like you do it. You talked about the elephant room. It happened. You talked about cocktails and it happened. You talked about, you know, everything you talk about, you do it. You follow through with it. And it's definitely commendable that you do that. So now, you know, when I talk to you and I have conversations and you say you're going to do something, I don't just go, oh, you know, she just. You know what I mean? Like, I'd be like, oh, okay, she about to make it happen, you know? And so you say you scaling Mount Kilimanjaro, I expect to see you.
Pictures and video.
Yeah.
You know?
That's
rough. So,
from the top of Kilimanjaro right here.
You know, kind of talk about that, like that drive that you have to make things happen. You know, is that something that's always been a part of who you are? Or is this something, you know, you found this later in life?
I think it comes from my ability to be a survivor, to be honest. I think that, know, my story is really sad and you know, comes from when I was 5 years old being abused. And when you're on the periphery of your own life from such a young age, you can't help but absorb and try to decide, like, how do you navigate these spaces that aren't safe? And as I tried to navigate the spaces, I developed a great sense of resiliency and a survival technique that had me continuing to hit walls, but then still be able to push through till I got to the other side of it. And I think that all those years of survival has really how to be resilient and to just persistent. And I think I also, because I have a learning disability and I've been told that it's a learning disability and I'm pretty high functioning, I always feel like I needed to prove something to people, because just because you have a disability or you suffer with trauma or anything like that, it doesn't mean that you don't have the ability to do things that other people can do. And I guess I carry that with me, and I want to prove to other people that they can do anything if they really discipline themselves and organize their life around what it is they set out to do.
Yeah, I mean, I really admire that about you. And also, one thing too, you have an athletic background as well. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I used to, in the beginning, I used to play softball at a pretty high level. Had I not run away from home, I would have probably attempted to be on the Canadian national team. You know, I was always into sports when I was younger. But after I had my last son, I decided to, because I was older, I was almost 40 when I was turning 40 when I was going to give birth to Brayden. And I heard horror stories about how you might lose yourself when you get pregnant so late in life. So, of course, I decided to do a fitness competition when I was like, I don't know, I was 33% body fat and I weighed like almost 200 pounds. And within 9 months, I was able to get down to 12% body fat and grace a stage with other people and come in third place. And I had never done anything like that before, but it's just like anything else. My education was like that. My fitness background was like that. It's kind of like I say I'm going to do something and I'm hard pressed to see, like, there has to be a really damn good reason why I can't do it. And I will try every angle until it is accomplished. And if I really want it and it's just harder to do, I'll just keep moving. If you just keep moving forward, you're going to get there. And so I take the hits, but I just, you know, I'm resilient. I keep coming back.
And you also represent two worlds. One is being a Canadian and also being a Grenadian.
Don't make me take out my flag.
So... Talk about a little bit about your Grenadian roots. And how, you know, because a lot of people, I don't know that people know a lot about Grenada.
What? How can they not?
Yeah, you'd be surprised.
I know, because, hi Ron, what's your name? I would say that Grenada is imprinted into my DNA. It's my heart. It's my weight in the water. It is the island that my heritage comes from, my ancestry. And, you know, my mother came to Canada back in 1962 as a domestic. And she was a maid for this white Jewish woman. And she was able to make something of herself by becoming a psychiatric nurse and really building something. But she always helped me to understand where she came from. My connection to Africa, who put me in African dance classes. I had African heritage classes. And I just felt a real sense of connection from where she came from. Even though she would warn me a little bit about, you know, don't bring too much of that into the classroom or into your social spaces, because she was very aware of how people would perceive that expression of my cultural heritage in a very white hegemonic space. And so I just found ways to integrate it into who I was, and I would always speak about it as if it was natural, like as if I was describing my hair, or it's like I'm also Grenadian. And Grenada is a very tiny island in the Caribbean, for those that don't know. I don't know how you don't know. America invaded it back in the 80s because they were afraid of our relationship with Cuba and Castro and Russia, because they were, you know, pushing socialism. And I actually ended up marrying the cousin of Morris Bishop, who was assassinated there. And that's who my son is a distant cousin of Morris Bishop. Malcolm X's mother was from Grenada. Amanda Seale is Grenadian.
We won't talk about that.
Beyonce's publicist, Yvette, is also Grenadian. Our parliamentary secretary, our former parliamentary secretary, was Grenadian. One of our first parliamentary secretaries was Grenadian. So we're a tiny island. There's only about 107,000 people, and probably double that outside of the island itself, because we couldn't all go home. It would stink.
Oh, wait, you forgot Mr. Killer. Run with it.
Yeah, so if you're into soca and things like that, then you know that Jab Jab is where you want to go if you want to have that kind of experience. And I incorporate those things into my artwork because it is so much a part of who I am. When you live in Toronto and you're Black, yes, you can be from Canada and just be Black like that, but there's very far in between. They're usually in Halifax, very small amounts in Southern Ontario, and there's a real disconnect between the Caribbean Black and the Canadian Black and the American Black. Mm. And all of these things kind of impressed upon me that we're just all from the continent, and we're in the diaspora, and we have our different representations based on our biographies and our histories. And I want to make sure that I bring that forward, but with a way that amalgamates us as people and doesn't keep us separate. We can all be different, but we all have to understand that we have a common history that brought us to the areas that we were in. And we have a lot more to talk about than, you know, the things that don't matter in this world. And I wish we'd focus more on that. Learn how to trust and love each other a little bit more.
Do you see Canada as your forever home, or is there somewhere? Where would you like to end?
Listen, ever since COVID, I don't even really recognize this country anymore. They got a little crazy with the vaccinations and all of that stuff. And I think that they have a very old mentality, and that's why so many popular Canadians end up going to the U.S., because there's a population that can handle the creativity that we come with. And I'm not saying, I know that I will create a legacy here because of that. Just like Drake did, but he didn't create it here. He created it here, and then we all were like, "Yeah, Drake!"
right.
So, and then people like Julie Black, who is very popular, but she didn't cross over to the U.S. She's become like a national treasure here, but it limits your ability to make the bank that you want to make in order to have your legacy match your efforts. And I think that that's where we become stagnant here. So if I stay here, I am breaking down some walls, but it requires so much of me. And now that I'm older, I don't think I want the same fight. I'm interested in a little bit of a softer life right now. I think I've earned my stripes. I think I'm just ready to like still break down walls, but do it more efficiently, more strategically, so that I don't have to work as hard as I was before.
Wow.
It's a scene over here.
So, you know, you're a working woman, you're a mother, you are a entrepreneur. You wear a lot of hats. I mean, how do you
wear a lot of hats?
Literally.
How are you able to do it?
You just do it. Like, you know, if you see these movies when people are working, can't stay on the session. Oh. Hi, I'm sorry you can't stay. How do I do it? You just do it. Like I don't shoot to miss. You know, I'm not here for practice. This is my life, and I have goals. I understand. I've been, you know, like I said, I'm on the periphery of everything that has kind of happened in my upbringing, and I observe culture. I observe how people are subjugated for ridiculous reasons. Some were punitive in the U.S. some more, you know, bureaucratic here in Canada. And some people aren't even aware. They're just, you know, blindly, you know, ignorant. But we all interact with each other from that space. And I think that it has developed a great distrust. And I think that motivates me because, especially having children, I want them to live in a world with more empathy and compassion. And I have to be a part of making that happen, you know, be the change you want to see in the world. That's why I do it. That's why I don't get tired to the point where I'll stop. But I want to plant seeds in people to recognize that they have the power to make the changes that they think are impossible. And I'm doing that. Everyone, they count me out all the time, but I keep coming. So they can do it too. Any of us can, if we discipline ourselves enough and organize our goals.
Now, this show, we talk to authors, and that's one of the hats you wear is an author, a two-time author, right, at this point. And first of all, let's talk about what was it that made you say, I must write a book?
If you know my life, I must write a book. And I attempted to write a book from a long time ago about my life. And it was incredibly difficult because it was incredibly painful. And I was in the middle of my healing. And I go to New York a lot because it's just, you know, across the pond type of thing. And when I go there, I have the best time. I meet, like, there's no black men here too much. Well, now there might be. But I have had a hard time meeting black men that are in the mindfulness that I have that can support the kind of resilience and the goals that I have. And so going to the U.S. at the very least was great for your ego. They really, black men love black women out there. They like white women too, a lot in Florida. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. I digress, which is a big part of how I write. What was the question?
Oh, no, what was it that made you want to write the book?
Yeah, the writing it down after trying to do my own story. I think that all my trips to New York, they were really fun experiences. Hey, Serena. Very fun experiences that I knew a guy who wrote eroticas. And I was like, ooh, maybe I could write an erotica because I've had some crazy ass experiences. So I started to write one after a trip that I took to New York and I wrote it down. And as I was writing it, I called him and I'm like, can I read you something? You know, I'm not really sure what I'm doing here, but can I read you something? And he's like, don't stop.
Read a little bit slower.
Yeah. One more time. But the hardest part about writing at first was that it was too personal. You do have to create some kind of distance between yourself and the pen because just like if you're acting, I guess you can get lost in the character that you are writing about. And if you don't have that separation, it will become a distortion of what is true. And so what I did was I created a character. It is a picture of me, but I asked somebody to illustrate me. Mm-hmm. And when I asked them to illustrate me, I was being very purposeful about two things. One, that she'd be naked on the cover. About a couple of things, three things. That she's naked on the cover, that she's looking back at whoever's going to be looking at it. And I recognize very clearly that if I physically was on the cover of this book, it would be received differently because of what black women go through. Our stories aren't as integral and important to people as a character of a black woman. They already characterize us. So why not give them what they're looking for? And if they dare to look inside, they'll get a lot more than what is just presented on the cover. He writes naked because my writing is naked. I'm very truthful, authentic, transparent, and vulnerable in the way that I write. She's looking back because she's also subject as well as object. And so that's why she's looking back at the people who are looking at the cover of the. So while she's naked and seems like an objectifying herself, she's letting them know that I'm looking back at you because I also have something to say in spite of you, you know, decompartmentalizing me in the way that compartmentalizing myself in a way that just looks at the things that people like my ass. It's pretty big in the book. it's okay. I mean, it is me. So I do these things on purpose because I think it already automatically creates a conversation. We live in a time where I was with someone for 16 years and I had to start dating after it crumbled, right? And that experience was traumatizing. And until I did my healing, and when I say my healing, I also always say that my living is my healing, because it's not just, you don't arrive at healing. You have to continue to heal constantly, and every situation is a new opportunity to heal. So my living is my healing, and I started to be able to find the humor in the experiences that I was having. And then I watch a lot of film and television, and the way that comedy works, I really just enjoyed that whole process of taking something that is very serious and then breaking it, because I don't want people that look like me to be reliving the trauma that I've gone through. Instead, I want to bring awareness to it while giving you a comedic break so that you can, it's palatable, you can take it in, and it's something that you can navigate a lot easier.
Now, did you pose for the cover of the book?
This is an old picture. I have this old picture from before I even thought about writing a book.
Oh, wow. So there's an actual picture like that.
There's an actual bunch of pictures. there's a bunch of pictures where I did a nude photo shoot. It was done in an artistic way. And I just thought, well, I'm calling myself a sex addict. I might as well give them a little bit what they're expecting while also giving them so much more. And that's what a good relationship is like. And I think I'm building a relationship with readers that can depend on the fact that I'm going to be honest. I'm going to be naked in the way that I tell my truth. And they can start to get a cadence for how I like to tell stories.
Did you find out something different or learn something about yourself as you started writing this series?
Yes, and that I'm a really great storyteller.
Okay.
that I can take complex issues and I can make them plain. There's a lot of things about relationships and our own personal development that we kind of just surface. We go on the surface of these things. And there's a lot of depth to the way that we communicate what we're doing. In my new book in particular, I talk a lot about the difference between the space between the trigger and the response, meaning that I might be triggered by something, but something happens internally with me before my behavior is projected a certain way. And it's within that little space that seems like it's like really fast that really the difference between my resilience and me and my comfort exists in that space. A lot of things that we do, we are not paying attention. We're underestimating the power of our choices and our ability to make those choices and where they're coming from, your why. You know, why are you doing the things that you're doing? I ask myself that all the time. Why are you doing that? Especially if you're not getting the outcome that you're looking for, you want to be able to understand why you're doing something. You know, if you just keep doing it over and over again, you're not going to make that shot. And I don't shoot to miss. So I plan on making the shot. That's just how I do it.
All right. So this is loosely about your life, right? Pretty much it's about your life. It is. So are there people that would read the book and go, wait a minute, she talking about me?
Well, yeah.
Has anybody ever come back to you and said, wait a minute?
I've read this, each story that belongs to a person, I've read it to them.
Really?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I like to be a fly on the wall for that one.
It actually goes over really well. Like, for example, my ex-husband, he's my prologue in this book all day, you know, and I read it to him and his response was, I'm so sorry. I didn't know I made you feel that way.
Wow.
This isn't about throwing people under the bus. This book is about self-accountability. This is the adventures of a recovering sex addict. So the process of what I'm looking at is in the healing. It's not in just the escapades, but people want the escapades. So I give it to them. But I also let them know that there are consequences to living your life without really thinking about why you're doing things the way that you are. So it really is an adventure through relationship after relationship or encounter after encounter, where I can recognize how I'm showing up, share that through, you know, like a stream of consciousness in a sense of my thought process of that trigger and behavior. Like, let's say my behavior is the sex addict. But before that was the abuse. So when I meet somebody that triggers a response from abuse, there's a whole bunch of things that I'm trying to work through, like shame and fear and expectations and shoulds and wouldas and all of these different things that make me act in a certain way. And until you are aware of why you're doing it, you're just running on, you know, you're just doing it habitually. And I didn't want to be on this train anymore, this wagon, the wrong wagon, where I just felt like I didn't have any control over my life. I always ended up on the floor crying. I was sad. I was depressed. I was suicidal. I didn't want to live anymore. And those, I felt like a prison. And so I didn't want to be in prison anymore. So I started to have to look at myself in a really, you know, personal, and I strip away everything. And when I got really empty, I was terrified because I didn't know what to put back inside. It's a process, and I go through it in great detail as I tell each story. You know, I talk about relationships with my mother, just different things that help me understand. And you're thinking, a lot of people were like, but you have such good sex scenes in there. And I'm like, yeah, having those situations are what they were or what they are, but it doesn't define who is the person that is doing those things. And if I can have an F-boy show up in my life, what am I doing to allow the F-boy to show up in my life?
Amen.
What am I doing with a married man? You know, something, I could put the focus on him, but I did it too.
Right.
Who was I showing up in that space? What was happening with me that allowed for that to be okay somewhere in my mind? And without our ability to explore that, we're going to hurt each other more and more. And I don't want to hurt anyone anymore.
For anybody that is going to date you, would you suggest them read your books beforehand? And
I don't know, because... And even my podcast, like I would go online and I would share all kinds of things about my life. And that became actually very problematic in the dating space, because with my trauma, I had a hard time determining what was safe and what was threatening. And so people would come like snakes in the grass, charming me because they think they understand something about me. Even without reading it, they just automatically think, oh, they just see the title and they're like, oh. Like, I met a guy the other day when I was walking my dog, and he was like, he Googled me or something, and he came across what I'm writing or what I write about. And he texts, he sends it to me, he forwards it to me. And then he's like, I guess we can't have sex then.
Wow.
So they are.
That's the first thing.
That's the first thing. You know what I mean? It's just ridiculous.
Uh-huh. So, that's kind of like a thought you keep in your head.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But people tell me everything, so I'm not surprised. And then that also brings out their own, they feel like they can tell me their deepest, darkest secrets, because clearly I can.
Because you're telling yours, yeah.
So then it makes them feel safer to tell me theirs. So, I mean, if anything, I'm starting a conversation, which is what I want to do. I want to start that conversation, and I'm okay putting myself out there. Now, in terms of finding my own love, I heard that, you know, stop looking for it, number one. And continue to work on yourself and the things that you're doing, and they will see you doing what you're doing, and they'll like that about you, opposed to trying to have myself fit into what I think somebody else wants. That was driving me crazy, trying to match other people's expectations of myself.
It's a lot of work.
You know I'm saying, and I do enough already because I'm neurodivergent right. Anyway, with the way that I think. So I think that when I do my work, I stopped thirsting for that connection with men and validation with men. I didn't look for that anymore, because I was giving it to myself, and I was, you know, doing something that was worthy of something. And when I finally was in the zone of doing it after writing the second book, doing the movie, those experiences also were transforming me, because I had to be different to show up to even do this kind of stuff, right? So as I started to formulate into a new person, I started to attract different types of people.
Yeah.
And now I'm happy with them.
That's good.
Is your writing process for, say, this series, is it the same? Has, or was it the same for both books?
No. This book is a lot more, I call my genre, by the way, self-help erotica. So this one is way more erotica than self-help. And this it's kind of self-help, but not really. It's actually community help, because I'm helping people figure out how to communicate. I'm really promoting relational wellness, but by owning your own shit. You have to own your shit in order to show up and be able to communicate with people. And, you know, I also would like to say that my brand is very much for men and women. I don't believe in the white feminist rhetoric of like emasculating Black men and putting men down. And we would say if we were from Jamaica, which if you're from Toronto and you're Black, then you're just an honorary Jamaican. That's why our slang and everything sounds like we sound like a really bad Jamaican accent.
Yeah.
It's because we're not all from Jamaica, but we're all trying to be. but yeah, I think that I'm attracting the right type of people to my life right now. I am showing up differently, and I'm at peace. I finally found the peace that surpasses all understanding, and I want to create space for people to be able to show up within that peace in order to have conversations. You can't be angry and come to that solution, right? And I think a lot of us don't feel heard because we don't create space, and Black men in particular, a lot of us women don't create space for them to show up. We don't create space for them to have emotions. And I've been very passionate about that because I have two Black boys. I raise Black men. And when I see how the little girl treats them, I'm like, that's going to get worse as they get older.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So own your shit and create space for those that you're interacting with. And you'll be surprised at the outcomes that you can have when you do that.
Wow. You know, it's interesting to find out from you the responses you get from people who read the book, especially men and women. Like, are they similar responses? Are they different? I'm really interested.
I get men that say, men give me a lot of feedback in the sense that they recognize themselves in what I've characterized. Right, I can see that they tell me that they can recognize themselves, and in women they feel the shame, and they're like, they whisper like, "Girl, I know what you're talking about there, girl." It's kind of that kind of thing. Whereas men are like, "I've been that guy," and then there somebody else was like, "It's really interesting to see how a woman is interacting with the behaviors of men, whether it's about me sleeping with them or not." It's because I really break down my thought process. So when a man is trying to approach a woman and they're unclear on how to do that or whatnot, you get a glimpse into what might be happening for the woman when you advance her in a certain way. Because sometimes men be missing how to do that. And you know, no hurt to them. It's just that they show up in this world based on how they've been allowed to show up in this world.
Yeah.
And how we've treated them. So I really think that creating space for people to show up as they are, by revealing the truth of who they are, they're getting a catharsis, is the general idea that I'm getting from people. There's a catharsis of them recognizing themselves and appreciating the healing part of it, because they don't know what to do. It's the first time that they're even coming face to face with some of their feelings, because they didn't even know that that's what it was. You feel it, but you can't name it. And I think what I'm doing is naming things that people just had feelings towards. It's really powerful, because when you can name something, you can start to do something about it.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really fun. It's really fun.
I wonder though, the guys that didn't make the book, are they like upset? Like, where am I at?
I don't know, because I only speak to the ones that I do put
that are in there.
And the other thing is about these books is yes, I'm calling myself a sex addict, but I'm really just more of a love addict. So it's not like I'm in these streets, like just like out there like that, which that is a type of sex addiction. It's called hypersex addiction, but I don't have that particular type of sex addiction. So I'm not in the streets. I'm not like, if anything, I'm a monogamous person. I go from one person to the next. I've never slept with two people on the same day. Stuff like that. It's not like, and honestly, the men that I was with as a result of the addiction, it became a part of like a release. So I used to describe it as cutting. I felt like I was the way that people would cut themselves to feel like they're relieving a piece of a pressure on them. I was relieving something about myself that was giving me the illusion of connection and belonging with that individual that just wasn't true.
Wow. That's very deep. I'm sure there's people who tell you all the time that they read your book and, you know, maybe that they were able to see some things in themselves. Like, I know you said the guys did, but I'm sure some of the women.
Definitely the girl. Everyone sees themselves, if they're being honest.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about human things. I'm not just talking about men and women things. I'm talking about that vulnerable space where we show up to want to connect with someone, and for one reason or another, it's not working. You know, when a man gets shut down, or when a woman is ghosted, or all of these different things. You can say I was ghosted, but then what does that do to the other person when that happens? Nobody's thinking about that. So those are the kinds of things that I reveal. And you might think twice about doing it because, you know, there's a different checklist other than, I'm not getting all my needs met, so therefore I'm ghosting this person.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever ghosted somebody? Have you ever ghosted someone?
Yes, but I go through the process of how I get there. And for those who you would think I would ghost in the stories, and I don't ghost them, you're like, why didn't she get rid of that person? So there's a whole, like in the new book, I create what I call a SWOT analysis. And because it's called friends with benefits, but mostly liabilities. And so the reason is because, you know, if you think about doing an investment, your relationships are an investment. And so therefore, when you are investing in a relationship, you want to do what kind of they would do for a product or a service. They would do a SWOT. What are the strengths? What are the opportunities and threats of that product or service? Should I be investing in that product or service? So you should do the same approach with your relationships. What are the strengths? So, you know, here you are, a couple.
Mm-hmm.
You saw fit that you are investing long-term in one another, right? So that means that there's enough strength, and whatever weaknesses there are, there's opportunities from those weaknesses, and the threats are minimal. So you've come to an idea that, you know what? Nothing is safe in this world, but based on analysis, I'm going to go for it because it's worth that investment. Whatever it was that you prioritize in your life as high value, and whatever is, you know, the deal breakers,
mm-hmm.
the strengths outweighed them. And so therefore, here you are. Even in platonic relationships, which I also talk about, this is not just about men that I have had intimate relationships with. I talk about girlfriends that are just trifling, that, you know, treat women a certain way. And think they can get away with that kind of stuff without being accountable. And maybe they have, but I guarantee you when they read it, they're going to feel ashamed of themselves. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to make you feel ashamed. I'm trying to shake you into a reality that you need to be more accountable to how you show up. We need to stop putting so many expectations on people. It's too much for us to bear.
Right. You know?
Kinte, don't put so much on Renee that she can't feel like she can breathe. And Renee, don't put Kinte under a glass jar and try to like own him. We can't own people. We've been through that, Black people. We've been
through
that. Renee?
Yeah. Are you listening, Kinte?
Yeah, but it's true. And, you know, I think that I go back to my very first lesson I got from the Bible, oddly enough, which was God gave us the choice of how to love him. And I believe that that is the template by which we need to show up in our relationships. Give people the choice to choose you. If you're not chosen, don't turn crazy. There's a reason why.
Right.
And just go back to your SWOT. Your SWOT will help you understand that that wouldn't have been a good investment anyhow. Some investments are great short term, but then you know how to set boundaries so that you're not giving long-term investments to a short-term return.
Wow.
Right? You don't want to
spend that. Right.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what it is. People say, I never thought about it that way. This
right.
makes sense. LA, I get you. I see myself. You know, I'm giving people things to think about and how to approach their own lives. And I really am grateful for the opportunity to do that. Because you don't want your life to be, I don't want to be remembered for all of the pain I went through. I want to be remembered for the change I created. And I think that's the critical mass that I'm trying to create right now is, you know, I want Black people to see that there is another way of imagining our interactions. I feel like our imaginations have been stunted, that we are so caught in the narrative of what happened to us in the past that we don't know how to imagine anything different for ourselves past that enough, but past what happened before, you know? When we think about mythologies, I think I said this on the Elephant Room on this platform a time ago, the mythologies of our people, you know, it really tells you about who you are. So if we're deep in the enslavement conversation, then that's how we're gonna keep referring to us. You know, the fact that we went from slaves to now calling ourselves enslaved is a jump, because the mentality of a slave is different from somebody who was enslaved, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when we went from, you know, Negro to Black to African, like we're our awareness of who we are keeps changing, and that mythology is what's allowing for the changes to happen. Without the mythology, we don't have it. But when hip hop came into this existence, it gave us a mythology until it was co-opted by capitalism and turned into something where it was now reinscribing who they want us to be in order to perpetuate that capitalistic idea and keep us subjugated underneath what we need to be doing. That's what it's doing. But if you tell a Jamaican, let's say, that they're not good, do you understand the cuss you're about to get? Jamaicans know who they are because their national mythology is that we are Jamaicans. You know, there's a whole, I had to stand up straight to even say it.
Right.
The country perpetuates that within the people. But when you think of yourself as enslaved, you walk differently.
Right.
And that's the subtle differences that I'm talking about, that my stuff, it's pinpointing those kind of like nuanced differences, those idiosyncrasies that we're taking for granted because we don't understand how it's intersected into how we see ourselves. That's what we need to break. They're telling us who we are. We're not imagining something different for us.
Right.
It's like robots walking it out and giving them exactly what they want us to do. I'm not down for it.
Right.
It's not, I was born in hip hop. Like I just turned 50.
That's right.
Hip hop. So I'm as old as hip hop. And that thing was birthed in me. That creates that, like I was of the times of KRS-One, of Africa Bambaataa. They had that's a different type of hip hop than here now.
Than now, yeah.
Right? So that mythology is what I was brought up in. So that's why I speak this way. What are our kids gonna be speaking now that capitalism has done its thing with it? Like, God love all of these people that are popping their pussy and twerking their asses. Like, if that's what you feel is empowerment, then more power to you. But are you really empowered?
Right.
Because when I try to follow that as a woman, I end up on the floor crying because I'm getting ghosted because he got what he wanted, and now he has no.
Now he's gone. Yeah.
Anymore.
Mm-hmm.
How empowered am I?
Right. Oh, you're right. You're right. Yeah. He turns into Casper.
Yeah.
Wow. Before we transition to another aspect of what you're working on, I just want to let the audience know this is episode 2 of the Spotlight Authors Edition, and Friday we're going to have episode 3, and we'll be joined by Jen, and the topic is, so you've written a book, and now you're sending it to your editor, so we're going to talk about that. on that, and that's Friday's show. So,
right.
All right. I just wanted to get that out the way. Yeah. All right. So, not only are you an author, and you know, we didn't even get into Video Vixen. we didn't even get to that, but you know, maybe another time. But
I'm a video vixen. I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Oh, we're gonna act like. you are also a filmmaker as well now. So,
yes.
I mean, just incredible. So talk about that.
I cannot be happier. Okay, so as I told you, I was trying to write my biography, but it was too hard. And then writing the little like relationship stories became easier. So I wrote that. Simultaneously, I had a long time ago with my old editor, Sheldon Shaw, big up yourself. We had started to write like a couple of pages of a screenplay of what it would be like to, you know, tell my story through a screenplay. And so I used that, and I worked with a gentleman named Carlos Anthony here, who is a grant writer but has done a lot of non-unionized productions. And he's like, oh, you got that? We can film that over the weekend and then apply for a grant. So he did. He got all of the people together. He submitted the, we filmed the thing. You can see it on my YouTube channel, what I used to create the movie and get the grant. And I submitted it. And as I finished writing this book, I got the acceptance from the Canada Council of the Arts saying that
nice.
I was awarded, you know, pretty handsome amount of money to be a short film.
Wow.
And nice.
With Carlos's brilliance, he said to me, let's do it as a backdoor pilot. Yes, we'll do the short film, but let's film it in a way that it can continue because you have a lot of stories
mm-hmm.
to tell. So I thought, why don't I use parts of my book into the screenplay and make the film based off of the book? And so that's what I was able to do. I was able to create a short film using parts of my book. And I just recently turned, like I said, I turned 50 and I did the release of my book and an exclusive film screening. I sold out the theater. Actually, I didn't even have to sell out because I'm not allowed to sell it yet because I'm going into the film festival circuit, but I opened it up. You know, a lot of people came. There was a lineup outside. And when I sat in the dark with people and that movie played and that first beat hit of, because it's a comedy / dramedy, and I'm sitting in the crowd and that first joke, so to speak, happened, and I heard the eruption of everybody laughing at what I intended for them to laugh at. I there's no other feeling. I didn't know all those people. They weren't just my family saying, ha, 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 we get it, LA. It was people I didn't hardly know that was in there. It was people that I knew in there. It was the most inspiring moment of my life.
That is so cool. I'm so proud of you.
Man,
the drama. My mom walked up on the stage. Now, if anyone knows me, the history with my mother is like, it's intense. Okay. And she was terrified that I'm going to put all of the business of our family out there. So when she saw it, the response that I'm getting from not only her, but from many people is, this is so tastefully done. You know, you are bringing life to something, but you're not doing it in a way that is scandalous at all. So she walked up onto the stage with some flowers to give to me.
Aww.
And she told my son's gonna walk by.
And,
so as you can see, I don't hide my life from my son.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
she walked up there and she basically told the entire cinema that she was scared of what I was doing, but after seeing what she saw today, she's never been prouder that I'm her daughter. And people were
Man, I want to cry.
I couldn't believe my eyes. The standing ovation that I got afterwards. What was the most glaring thing for me in seeing that being a part of that moment was that I have transformed to be able to stand there and be in that moment. I earned that moment. I really earned it. And I wasn't swayed by, you know, people get really emotional after they do certain things. And I recognized I created that distance that I was talking about. There is the distance between myself, who I truly am, and the art that I'm creating for the benefit of everyone. And so as they stood up, I was very moved. I was very happy. But I didn't once feel like crying. Not once. Because I worked so hard. Yeah. There's nothing to cry about. I'm supposed to celebrate that. I'm supposed to. And that's the difference. When you know how to receive the love that you never knew how to give to yourself, those people were clapping, but I had already given myself the love, which is why I was able to do it in the first place. So that was just more of an affirmation more than it was a validation. My validation came from me, and they affirmed it with their standing ovation, and I felt really, really proud. I was surrounded by people afterwards. I couldn't even get off the stage. I felt like a rock star.
You definitely are.
I knew right then and there that the adventures really have just begun. I always said, let the adventures begin, but the adventures really have just begun. I can't wait to start the tour. I can't wait to kick off everything that I'm planning for 2024 and the film festivals. And of course, the very, very special Professor James Small coming and taking me under his wing as a mentee has been, I think that's also made a big difference for me, because he told me that all content is intent and that it's a part of self-creation. And his words and his guidance has really helped me anchor myself in the knowledge of self. And I really want to share that with other people. So I'm looking forward to the tour and bringing out conversations that aren't too heavy. Hey, Stephanie, I love that girl, man. I haven't seen heard about her in so long.
Yeah, and happy birthday, Stephanie, by the way.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
What was her name again? It was so dope. She used to have this name.
Oh, So Steph.
So Steph. Oh, that's my girl right there.
You know what? That threw me off, too, because when she, I was like, why are you calling yourself so? And then I was so deaf. I was slow. I was slow on that.
You're gonna get your black card taken away, Tuesday.
I know.
Yeah, I might have to cut it up.
Right? Yeah, I was like, why would you call yourself so?
You blessed through your wife.
Better than that. So, yeah.
But yeah, so Steph is one of my favorite. I'm hoping I still get to meet her one day, because I just loved how she articulated herself. She was funny, she was sexy, she was sassy, and I never even met her in person. But all through her word and the little picture that pops up when I see her, I'm like, this girl's a vibe. This is my girl right there.
No, nah, she's awesome.
Yeah, I might have to cast her in a movie or something.
Hey, that's for sure. So man, that is so cool. Like I'm seriously living vicarious through you, because just to see where you've come, and you just do incredible things, and I'm just so proud of you. And I know you have so much more to go. I mean, this is just the beginning.
It's
just the beginning. And I know you were we were working on a reality show for a while. Are you still doing that?
So I was on I was taking behind the scenes photography for a Nigerian housewife show here in Toronto. And then I was doing Cocktails with LA more regularly that those times. And so they asked Cocktails with LA to host their reunion special. You're welcome, sweetie. And after hosting their reality special, they were like, I think you should become one of the wives on our show. And I'm like, I'm not Nigerian. I'm like, it doesn't matter. People from the Caribbean say that they don't know where they're from anyway, so it won't matter. I'm like, okay, that's my storyline. And they allowed me to do Cocktails with LA and me wanting to be a media trailblazer. So I'm like, that works. That hits. I'm going to do that. And
Where's your Nigerian husband at?
One of them was married. Everybody else was divorced.
Oh wow, that is so crazy about that.
It's like the housewives show.
They're not with anybody,
right?
He wasn't even Nigerian. He was Jamaican.
Oh wow. why did you say different Negro housewives?
You know what I'm saying? We were supposed to do like ancestry.com. It was supposed to be a big reveal that we actually have like 90-something% Nigerian. But that never happened. I learned a lot on that show of what not to do in film. Mm-hmm. So no hate to them. You know, good for them because they're breaking barriers. And I big them up for that. It's hard. It's definitely hard. But again, organization, discipline, having the right team, having good writing makes a big difference when you're filming something. So I pray that they get those elements together and they do their thing. But I will never be back on that show. Mm-hmm. They wanted the fighting and all that stuff. I'm like, I'm not promoting that.
Right.
The stick was that I was the weed head on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Place for me because, you know, Canada, Toronto smoke, you're allowed to smoke weed here. And it was just something where they wanted to fight. I was the great comic relief where I could just, like, I'm going to just blow this shit out to deal with this.
I know that was a stretch playing weed, right? Did they have to show you how to smoke the doobie?
Yeah, I walked around with this pen all day.
Hilarious.
No, but it was quite the experience. So but I have created a reality TV show that I would love to pitch. Mm. So what I heard about when you're pitching, like the TV show is something I want to pitch. But I've heard a lot of times that when you're in those rooms, make sure you have other things that they can, because they might say, well, what else do you have?
Hmm.
And I'm going to say, honey, you should ask. I have about two or three other things that I am working on, you know, low-key that are really, you know, really great.
You know, some of the biggest projects were that got made were because somebody was like, well, what else do you have?
What else do you have?
A lot of, like, Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just real quick, Michael Crichton, who wrote Jurassic Park, he was working with Steven Spielberg, creating ER, the TV show ER.
Oh yeah,
it was going to be a movie.
ER.
Yeah, it was going to be a movie. Wow. The pilot would have been the movie.
That would be weird.
And he was a doctor, Michael Crichton.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of like the Noah Wiley character is really him. So what happened was he was like, what else you got? And he said, well, I'm writing this thing about dinosaurs and DNA. And then he was like, Steven Spielberg said, he hadn't even wrote the book yet. He was like, I'll give you $1 million. I'll give you $1 million for the rights right now. He's like, I haven't even wrote the first chapter. He's like, I'll give you $1 million.
Wow.
I'm like,
you can't say no to Steven, right?
Declared that I am going to become a millionaire within the next 2 years. And if I say it, it's going to happen. So get ready. I'm coming for everybody. Because then I want to retire my man. You know, when I find the man that I'm going to be with, I need him to work with me. I can't. Like, so I need to find somebody that's going to work with me because I believe in keeping it all in the family.
Right.
And he can't be needing to go work for other people.
Right.
Work together. We'll co-create the company. And he's going to have skills that I don't have. And we're going to do amazing things together.
Yin and yang. peanut butter and jelly.
You know, definitely the jelly.
Oh wow, man. I am like I said, I am so ecstatic. Every once in a while I have to do a check-in just to see what you're up to. And it's always just lovely things that you're working on. And I'm like I said, I'm, you know, I get a little emotional when you tell me about some of the things you're doing. And I just know, like I said, I've known you for a while now, and just to see all the things that you're doing and you've done, it's just incredible. And I want to thank you so much for, one, coming on the program to share with us. And so what should we be on the lookout coming up soon for you?
Okay, so as of next year, we launch straight into the What Do You Thirst For tour, where I will go around showing the movie and doing our Q&As. You see all those videos that people are passing around about relationships and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
They're great, but I think that it needs some context. So what it does is my books and my movies allow for the conversation to become contextualized around the issues that we really need to speak on. So I'm launching a North American tour. I'm creating an RV that's going to be like a traveling bookstore and movie studio and
nice studio.
So when I pull up in LA in my big RV, you can say, you got to come on and do your podcast. On the bus.
Sure, we'll do it. We'll do some live in front of an audience.
Yeah.
And it'll be awesome. So we'll,
and you so, know. Let me just say, Mike Truth will be the official host of the What Do You Thirst For tour. I'm going to bring Mike on tour with me.
Oh, nice.
Right? We have to see his
family. Mike, that's the homie right there. I haven't, how's he doing?
He's actually sick right now. He has a bit of a cold.
Oh, okay. Just a cold. Okay.
I hope it's just a cold, you know. Right. There's a lot of weird things happening to people as after getting vaccinations. There's a lot more. And if you're going to pretend like it's not there. I don't want to get political, but something's going on in these streets.
Yeah. You know, he's like the African Dos Equis guy, the most interesting man in the world. I mean, that brother he's always doing something cool or whatnot. Man, I like that brother a lot. So you tell him I gave him a shout out.
Yes, definitely. Mike Truth will be the official host. And so we'll be going along. The first stop is January 26th. It's not the official launch day, but we will be at the University of Manitoba in the Human Rights building there. And followed by that, we're going to do our launch with Professor James Small at a small restaurant here in Toronto. So if you want, you know, if you can make it down here for February 1st, we'd love to have you. And then we start to go to Brock University, and hopefully we'll just continue doing the different schools. But I really, if there's a plug for the HBCUs or any fraternities or sororities that want to connect me so that I can get into the U.S. with this tour, we're happy to come along and have the conversation, show the movie. I've entered into quite a few film festivals. So not only will I show up at the film festivals, I want to go into the local community that don't get the opportunity to go to the film festival and show up in their community and bring it to them. And maybe what I can do, if we're going to red carpet things and whatnot, is create some type of launch where a local person that doesn't get the opportunity to have those kind of experiences can become my date at one of the film festival red carpet events. Because I just think things like that are important. Experience is so important to expanding your imagination. And that's why my bus is going to look crazy, because they're going to be like, this is just ridiculous. I'm just trying to birth something new in all of us. We are not buried. We are planted, and we can grow up to be, you know, the trees by the riverside that we were told about. And
I like that. We're not buried. We're planted.
It's not mine, but you know what I'm saying.
I was about to say, whoa. I'm like, you said copyright that.
Right? I don't know where I heard that, but I know that it's a thing, because some, you know, that's how I feel. A lot of us feel like we're buried under all of our circumstances, but sometimes we're being planted instead. And when it's the right time with the right environment, we're going to sprout, and then we're just going to keep growing. That's what I hope for our community.
Right. Well, thank you once again for coming on the program.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Renee, do you have anything that you want to promote or anything?
Almost done with the third children's book. So
yes,
right. My goal is before December 31st.
Love those kind of goals.
Yes,
I love it.
Like the people writing. If you write about 1,200 words a day, mm-hmm. you get to the end of your book in a good amount of time. Like I write my books. The first book was from July to October. This book was from the end of August to November.
Okay.
You know, writing about 1,200 words a day, you're going to get something that you can really work with. Don't over-scrutinize the 1,200 words.
Mm-hmm.
You can edit.
That's right.
You need the words to edit. So just write it down.
Yeah, and I say the only limit in writing is punctuation. So keep writing.
I love it. Comma.
I like it. All right. And once again, I want to let people know that this Friday, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 Eastern, we'll be joined by Jen, and we'll be talking about what to do once you've written a book and now you've given it to your editor. So that should be a good topic. You know, I can speak for Renee. We both love you very much, L.A.
Yes.
And can't wait to see you in person. So I will definitely see you out here for sure. Maybe if we get enough time, we can do a little event or something.
Yes. Oh, Andre, if you're still watching, I'll be in New York March 20th to the 24th for the Women's International Film Festival. I would love to be able to show the film, even on a small scale, to Staten Island, if you're still there. Hit me up. Let me know. I would love to come out there. That's how we start the momentum. I booked my first thing in New York.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. With that said, we'll see you guys Friday and have a great rest of your week and God bless.
All right. Peace out.
Yeah. Thank you.
Amazon.
Get the books.